Okay, meeting will come to order. Government Operations and Veterans Affairs Committee today on March 9th. We do have a quorum. Approval of minutes, Representative Kahn.
Move adoption of minutes.
Thank you. Representative Kahn moves approval of the minutes of the meeting of March 8th. Any discussion? All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and minutes are approved. Thank you. Members, we have three bills up today, and we have floor session at noon. We're going to try to get out of here by about 11:40 or so. First bill up is Representative Smith. It's House File 1109, and you should have had a sheet in your packet yesterday that hopefully you saved, talk about firefighting training. And Chair will move that House File 1109 be recommended to pass to the General Register. Representative Smith, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, thank you, and thank you for the motion. Members, the bill before you revives and reenacts the statute that established the Board of Firefighting Training and Education in 2000. It carried, the original bill carried a sunset date of December 31, 2003. And just as a reminder, the bill passed in 2000 passed the House by 124-6 votes and the Senate by 63-0. The board has the function of developing a consistent set of standards for training of Minnesota firefighters, whether they be professional or volunteer. The bill before you is one of the requested pieces of legislation by the fire service this year. It has been before the Public Safety Policy and Finance Committee, and it was approved, passed, that be recommended to pass, re-referred here. And, Madam Chair, I would ask that your motion be granted, and if there are any questions, we'll try to answer them.
Questions from members. Representative Kahn.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I just want to know if this is one of the boards that Representative Seifert so proudly told us he eliminated and nobody ever asked or complained about being eliminated, and so it was all right to eliminate it. And he had eliminated what, 60 out of 80 or 80 out of 100 or something? Is that
actually, that was...
Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, this isn't one of those. Actually, I looked at it, and that was after this. So this is one that someone beat me to the punch on, apparently.
Uh-oh.
I think it was a sunset that... who was the guy that was in... the DFLer that was in Gavotte that wanted to do it.
I voted against all sunsets.
Yeah, I think that was somebody that predated me. But,
okay.
You know, if it's a good thing to do, let's vote for it today.
Representative Smith. Representative Kahn.
Have we ever had, well, maybe Mark Shepard is the person that, have we ever had language in statutes before that revives and reenacts retroactively something?
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, I do remember one other case like this involving an advisory council in the health or medical services area where it was the intent of the people felt it should not have been sunset and it was revived retroactively.
Representative Ruth Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the author, Representative Smith. Do you happen to know how the volunteer firefighters feel about this particular board?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, from my personal contact with them, just to let you know that there's 1,105,000 volunteer firefighters in the United States, which is roughly 80% of the 1,360,000 total firefighters in the United States. Not all of them have contacted me, but enough within the state, Representative Johnson, that tells me that this is uniformly requested by all firefighters.
Follow-up, Representative Johnson.
Just a thank you. Glad to hear it.
Good.
Okay. Representative Dempsey, could you?
I'll pass my...
Okay. Representative Smith, I see you have a guest with you there. Would you like Mr. Scott said to make a few comments? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, my name is Mike Stockstead. I'm the president of the Minnesota Professional Firefighters Association, representing the Minnesota Fire Services Joint Council, which is the group of all three of the fire service organizations. This is, in fact, our request to reenact the board. The board has been working. It was by accident that the sunset was missed. And everybody has come together to try and make sure that the actions taken over this past year by this board, who has continued to do the work that we've asked them to do, would be recognized.
Question from Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, and maybe the testifier can tell the committee how many actions have the board recommended that were retroactively authorizing? I mean, is it a whole lot, or is it just a few that they had to do to continue the services?
Mr. Stockstead.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney, there are just a few. There's a couple of programs that they have approved and the instructors that they have qualified. We want to make sure that moves forward, that those people don't have to re-qualify and those programs don't have to reapply to get their qualification to be taught. It's hazardous materials and it's weapons of mass destruction and homeland security classes that we're talking about.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Kahn.
Well, looking at this language, it's kind of weird. I'm looking at how the board is appointed, and I did notice we do the thing that I've said that I always like to do, is that the governor makes all the appointments, so that he can look at geographic diversity and gender diversity if he happens to be interested in that, which I doubt that he would be. But the this is very unusual because exactly the numbers, you know, the people who the governor is only given the exact numbers of people to appoint, and I wonder how that works. Does the governor have to? It doesn't say what happens if the governor doesn't want those people. It doesn't look to me. We've tried to do these so that the governor has discretion. We tried to make these appointments so that the governor has discretion, which I think is really good idea. And this, the way this is written, seems to remove the discretion from the governor. Does anyone have any comments on that?
I don't know, Mr. Sachs, if there's somebody else in the audience that who wants to attempt that one.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Sachs,
in the history of the board, the governor actually has contacted the associations and told them what he was looking for, not only geographically, but also gender. And those appointments have been changed. And actually last year when the board technically was sunsetted and the appointments that were made were based on those requests to get some gender balance and the appointments were traded out.
Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, I did notice it says members serve with compensation. For the rural people, have they gotten mileage? I mean, they don't get per diem, but do they get mileage or overnight expenses? And if so, where did the money come from if it's been expired for 3 years?
Mr. Stockstead.
Madam Chair, Representative, it sunsetted in December of 2003, so it's been just a short period of time. But with, in order to pass the board initially under a previous governor, there had to be no funding. So the associations that are listed and involved in those first three steps have agreed, actually the first four, the League of Cities is also partnered with this. They have agreed to pay the expenses of their particular representatives, and then the associations together pay the expenses of the townships and general public representative. In addition to that, there has been a gift given by the Thomas More Foundation to the board of $5,000 to operate those expenses that you're referring to.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Right. Any other questions for members? Is there anybody from the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? Okay, I think we're getting ready to vote here. Representative Smith, would you like to make a final comment before we vote on your bill?
No, Madam Chair. I would appreciate your and this committee's support, and it will be sent to the General Register.
Thank you. Chair renews the motion that House File 1109 be recommended to pass the General Register. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and bill goes to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Smith. Okay, next up is Representative Cox. It's House File 789. And where did Representative McNamara go? You're a co-author on here. Would you like to move the bill before you head out there real quick? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 789.
And that's going to the Civil Law Committee.
To be approved and go on to Civil Law.
Great. Thank you, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cox, welcome to the committee. Please explain your bill and what we're looking at here today as part of GovOps.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 789 is a bill that's dealing with the allowing the DNR to address some of the issues that we have related to water and assessing some administrative penalties for violations of law that are happening. It's important to note this is not a revenue bill. This is not generating money for the DNR specifically. It's basically just to bring compliance and corrective matters into place. And there's two parts of the bill that probably are specifically to your attention in the GovOps Committee. Section 4 on page 6, the last part of the bill, has some rulemaking issues. And then also on page 4, at the top of the page, on line 4, there's a ability to adopt some rules for administrative hearings on there. So those are the kind of two rulemaking portions in the bill. I'd be happy to have it. I have Kent Luxmo with me, and I'd be happy to have him run through the bill for, I don't know how much you care to know about the in-depth working of the bill, or if you just want to focus on the rulemaking portion.
Well, we would like to focus on rulemaking, but if you can give us a quick overview of the bill, I think that'd be great. Mr. Luxmo, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kent Luxmo. I'm the Director of the Division of Waters of DNR. Essentially, this bill provides us another tool for seeking compliance with state laws dealing with floodplain, shoreland management, wild and scenic rivers, and water appropriation and work in protected waters. The last two are the two where we have the most issues on an ongoing basis. And we do have civil restoration authority ability now. What this does is provides for an administrative penalty to go along with the orders to restore or the civil orders of the department. Other agencies currently have this. Ag, PCA, and Department of Health all have existing authorities, and this I think we're the one agency that that does not, or one of them at least. The basically this process was developed through the with non-felony enforcement advisory committee several years ago and looking at alternatives to traditional court actions. So this would expedite review. It would resolve the issue both for the person receiving the order and the agency quicker. It provides specifically for expedited hearings with the administrative law judge's office. The maximum penalty amount in the bill is $10,000. That is for the type of activity that is a repeat offender. It's a serious violation. Typically, that would be very rare that we would see anything of that amount. It's a range of from zero up to that. The penalties are forgivable if there is restoration. And our goal in seeking this legislation is to have another avenue for protecting the resource. Very quickly, Section 1 just talks about the authority for administrative penalty order. Section 2 of the bill is the contents of the order and the amount of penalty, the whole process. That Section 2 extends for the bulk of the bill, explaining the process. Then Section 3 is on page 6. That's just recovery of litigation costs and expenses, provisions that are consistent with the other agencies. And Section 4 was a rulemaking exemption. And as the rulemaking exemption, the other agencies have not gone through rule process either. They've developed a plan on how to administer this. And we have a draft plan that's in the process of being developed that specifically applies the procedures as outlined in the law.
Thank you. We do have several members with questions. First up is Representative Seifert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've seen a bill, I don't know if it was similar to this or what in the past that's come through. I don't know what did it not pass or whatever on administrative penalties. I know I've never been a fan of administrative penalties, and I don't know that I've ever voted for him. Representative Solberg and I kind of just have a philosophical disagreement with empowering agencies more than what we feel. Does this, maybe it's to the witness, does this go as a person's relief if they're accused and have a several thousand dollar penalty assessed against them? Do they go to district court? They go to the administrative hearings office. Is that their exit for relief for being able to face their accuser and so forth?
Mr. Lockesmull. Madam Chair, Representative Seifert. This bill provides for review to the administrative law judge, administrative hearing process. It's an expedited hearing. And then any appeals of that decision would go to the Court of Appeals. That you would find on page 4, line 33 and 34, where it says the final order may be appealed according to sections 1463 to 1469. That language is similar to all of the other agencies' bills, and that's the referral to the Court of Appeals.
Paula, Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, maybe to the witness, where does the money go if we start fining people $2,000 or $5,000 or whatever? Is that a general fund issue?
Mr. Lockesmull?
Madam Chair, Representative Seifert, yes. It doesn't specifically say where the money goes, and that means it goes to the general fund. It's not it's general fund revenue that the agency would not see.
And this bill will be going to civil law next.
Okay, and then the last question, Madam Chair, is Mr. Shepard probably remembers this, but we put into law here a couple of years ago in the Rule Reform Act, one of the two or three that we had, if someone wants to do something that has the force and effect of law, it either has to go through the legislature or it has to go through the rulemaking process. And that's so every citizen knows that someone has the force and effect of law, someone's going to be accountable. It's either going to be the legislature or the rulemaking process. By setting up this plan, an exemption from rulemaking, are we now starting to divert away from what we thought was going to be kind of a clear issue of accountability? I'm looking at page 6 on administrative penalty plans and so forth. I get nervous when we're going to do things that have the force and effect of law, and we just kind of tell the agencies, well, you come up with something, you can kind of do whatever you want, and tell the citizens this is the way the law is, but we just kind of pushed our responsibility off. Is this starting to divert from that?
Mr. Shepard.
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, I think in part that's a judgment for the committee, and it may depend to some extent on what is in the plan. As Mr. Lockesmull said, to the best of my knowledge, when the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department had their administrative penalty order, they did not adopt a plan as rules. They might have had a plan that they just implemented, and it is entirely possible a plan might not come within the definition of a rule. It might be just an internal operating procedure, but I'm not familiar with what the department with the contents of their plan.
Madam Chair, I would add too that the rulemaking that they would use in this plan has to be consistent with the bill. It would only address the things that are in the bill.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay, next up, Representative Kahn.
It's kind of like Representative Seifert's question, but the question is, why do you need to be exempt from the rulemaking procedure? Why can't it go through? Because one of the things I think we put in was an expedited rulemaking procedure, which is pretty. Why wouldn't you just go through that instead of asking for exemption? And did the other, you listed a whole bunch of departments that already of agencies that already have that. Did they go through a rulemaking process, or did, you know, how did they get that this authority?
Mr. Lockesmull, Representative Kahn, the other agencies just developed a plan and did not go through rulemaking. And our reason for having this is the plan pretty clearly outlines how we would apply this process, and the rulemaking process is very long and very expensive.
The expedited rulemaking process, I thought, is not supposed to be. Should we fix that up then? What's the problem with that, using that?
of Madam Chair Representative Kahn. The you know, there's still cost and time with the expedited rule. How much that would be, I guess I would have to go back and check. I'm not sure of the answer on that.
Representative Kahn.
I'm asking the rules expert, Representative Seifert, is it more than a 30-day comment? But it has a... No, it has some safeguards, which is, for example, you'll prepare this... Oh, okay. You'll prepare this plan, and then where do you see, you know, where is the plan? There's no... In this bill, there's no requirement for where the plan is published or for how anyone ever finds out about it. And, you know, maybe...
Mr. Shepherd, would you like to comment on that?
Madam Chair and members, a very brief summary of the expedited rulemaking process is that the agency publishes in the state register notice of the proposed rule and mails it to people on its mailing list. The agency then allows 30 days for comments, and then before publication of the final rule, the agency has to submit the rule to an administrative law judge in the Office of Administrative Hearings for review of legality, and then the rule can be adopted shortly after that.
Oh, Representative Kahn.
Why wouldn't you want to do any of those things with the plan?
Mr. Lotsmo.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn. What we were doing was following the process that the other agencies had followed. If it's the committee's desire to do expedited rule, we can certainly do that.
Well, Representative Kahn.
When did they do theirs?
Mr. Lockswell.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, it was several years ago. I'm not exactly sure of the dates. You know, more than...
Well, maybe we didn't have the expedited.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, that's entirely possible. But I don't know the exact date.
Well...
Representative Kahn.
You know, I would actually...
Mr. Shepherd, is there something that...
I would certainly, particularly if the department has no, you know, instead of saying the plan is exempt from the rulemaking procedures, say the plan shall use the expedited rulemaking procedures, however that would. So you don't have to go through the full Chapter 14, but I don't see anything that's so onerous in that process.
Representative Kahn, is that an oral amendment?
Yes, but I'd rather
okay. Clarify through
Mr. Shepherd. Do it,
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, members, I would suggest to implement what Representative Kahn said to on page 6, starting on line 22 after the period, delete the rest of the bill. So it'd be deleting the last two sentences of section 4. And then, Madam Chair, in its place, I would suggest stating that the commissioner may use the expedited rulemaking process in Minnesota statutes section 14.389 to adopt the plan. And I will write that down.
Representative Kahn has moved that oral amendment.
And Mr. Chairman, I suggest that if someone discovers that there's any problem, that if there's any problem with that, it's got a ways to go to fix it up. So,
let's get a repeat of that oral amendment, Mr. Shepherd, if you're ready. Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and members, the amendment would be on page 6, line 22, delete everything after the period, and then delete page 6, lines 23 to 26, and insert in its place, the commissioner may use the expedited rulemaking process in Minnesota statutes, section 14.389, to adopt the plan.
And thank you, Representative Kahn.
Madam Chairman, I see that automatically takes the title too and the heading.
Mr. Shepherd.
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
Okay. Any questions on the Kahn oral amendment? Representative Cox, would you like to comment on that?
I would be fine with that as the committee chooses to adopt that, as sounds like the DNR is able to work with that.
Okay. Any questions? I think we're ready to vote on this. To the Kahn oral amendment. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is adopted. I know I have Representative Sheldon Johnson on the list. Representative Kahn, was there anything further?
No.
Okay. Representative Sheldon Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Locksmore, can you give me a recent example of where this type of corrective action the DNR would be taking, so I can kind of picture how this would play out in real life?
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson, probably the best example is where somebody alters a lake outlet elevation either by raising or lowering, and thereby affecting many other people. And we've had a case in northern Beltrami County that took years to resolve, where it was a lowering of the lake level, and it took years for us to resolve through an administrative order, and then to district court, and finally an order getting permission from the district court for us to go and repair the lake outlet at the department's expense, and then sought to go back in to seek to recover the costs from the guy that did the work. So that took about 4 years to resolve. We think using this type of a process on those actions would lead to quicker resolution. And you could, draining a wetland, placing fill, substantial amounts of fill in a lake, some of those kinds of things.
Okay.
To this point,
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lockishmore, did you criminally pursue that individual, did the department?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, I don't believe so. And the criminal action, if we would cite him criminally as a misdemeanor, working in public waters without a permit, the penalty is $700. The cost of the restoration that we did was about $10,000 to put in basically a dam at the outlet where he excavated. And we did recover our costs through court. But I don't believe he was charged criminally.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cox.
Representative Johnson, there have been instances that I'm aware of in my area where fill was probably inadvertently placed in wetlands, mainly because a wetland delineation was not secured before the work was being done. In that case, having this administrative penalty in place would make sure that it's coming out. I think that if people knew that there was something that was assessed and it was removed, and then as Mr. Lockesmore pointed out, if everything is fine and it's inadvertent, and there's ability to waive the penalty and just get the corrective action done.
I know we have a couple other members with questions, but before we get to those, I'd like to welcome students in our audience. They're from Malacca High School. Welcome. And currently we're reviewing House File 789 with Representative Cox, and its administrative penalty orders relates to a Department of Natural Resources. Okay, for questions, next up is Representative Kahn.
Yes, the question is about the comment that you made that the penalties will go into the general fund. They're a violation of a game and fish thing. Why wouldn't they go into the game and fish fund?
Representative Kahn, they're in violation of the public water statute. It's not a game and fish statute, they're in violation.
No, but some of these must be. Some of these possibly could be.
Madam Chair, the violation typically is 103G245, which is, they're coming out of the public waters section of the law, not the game and fish section. So, we are protecting game and fish habitat, but it's done through the public waters protection piece of that.
Representative Kahn.
Brings me to another more interesting question, which is, have you ever used... could you use this against, big cities or big industries?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, we could use this against any entity that violated the statutes, whether it's a municipality or an individual or
Let me
company.
Give you an example.
Representative Kahn.
City of Minneapolis is ignoring the DNR's requirement to review shoreland use ordinances. Is that the kind of thing that you could go after?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, I don't believe so.
How about criminal penalties?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, it might be tough to have the district the county attorney pursue that. But I doubt we could go criminally or use this. This is for the an actual violation where they are filling, like fill in the floodplain.
Exactly. Putting things in the floodplain.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, to go after a city for their for not following the desires of the agency, I don't believe that would be a place to use administrative penalty order. I think we would seek other avenues.
And how about the people that did it? There's almost nobody here. This is a follow-up continuation of the Condorita fight.
Uh-oh.
So
I remember.
So what about the people who did it? Could you go after them? Did you need some encouragement to go after them?
Mr. Lockesmore. Madam Chair, Representative Kahn.
You're aware of it?
Oh, I'm very aware of that. I've been around far too long. Yes. Could you go after the people that did it, that placed the bill that did that? Yes. And
would you like an amendment here to require you to do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, no.
All right, I'll wait to the floor for that.
Okay. Next up on the list is Representative Aaron Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the author and testifier. On page 1, lines 12, 13, 14, and the period on 15, it claims violations to be corrected, and then goes on to say permits for activities affecting the course current or cross-section of public waters or appropriating or diverting waters of the state. I'm just wondering, what does that mean for, ag-based landscapes that are, somebody goes out and modifies a drainage ditch or the wetland gets affected for some reason. I'm wondering I'm not 100% clear as to the extent of the penalty or the violation regarding those three sentences, those three lines, I mean.
Mr. Lockesbone, Madam Chair and Representative Peterson, the course current cross-section language is existing statutory language in the permit section of law. So that's why that's there. This is dealing with public waters on line 14. So those are only the wetlands and the water courses and the lakes that have been identified by the department as a public water. They're identified on the map. So those, it's not an individual farmer who may have a wetland on his land. It's not the Wetland Conservation Act wetlands, the WACA program. This is only the DNR regulated wetlands that are identified on the official maps, and they're done for each county. And the following piece for appropriating and diverting waters of the state is more inclusive. That includes groundwater and appropriations from lakes or rivers or other sources of surface water. And that would be for somebody that would be appropriating water more than 10,000 gallons a day or a million a year, the threshold that require a permit.
Thank you for the clarification. No follow-up.
Okay. Any other questions from members? Representative Glockler.
Madam Chair, and perhaps this is to Mr. Shepherd, as someone who's trying to understand administrative procedures, but it seems like we have a couple of different things going on here. You can appeal it to an administrative law judge who is just advisory to the commissioner. But then there is under, on page 5, lines 8 through 13, an alternative dispute resolution where you can go into mediation. And it's not clear to me whether that if you go into mediation, can you then take it back through the administrative law process if you're not happy with that result? Or can you appeal that? That paragraph seems to just be sitting there by itself, but I'm not very familiar with these statutes.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair, members, and I hope Mr. Loxmo will correct me if he has more specific information. It would be my understanding that what would happen after mediation would typically be governed by the scope of that agreement to mediate. I don't think a person would necessarily be giving up their right to contest this through the Office of Administrative Hearings. If, on the other hand, they entered into some type of a private agreement for binding arbitration, then that might be subject to review only under the Uniform Arbitration Act, which might involve giving up a right. But as I read this, it says the commissioner may do this if the commissioner and the person to whom the order was issued both agree. So as I read it, it would be somewhat up to them.
And Madam Chair,
Mr. Lockesbone,
Representative, The alternative dispute resolution can come at most any point in the process. The individual would have to demand a hearing within the time frame specified, and then if both parties are agreed before going through the expedited hearing, you could do some type of mediation. And we are doing that on in the civil process that we have right now. We have an issue in southern Scott County that we actually went through mediation on. So we have used that. I believe the alternative dispute resolution is something that's pretty uniformly applied in law now, so that option is there to use other avenues than administrative hearings or courts to resolve disputes.
Follow-up, Representative Wofler.
Well, it appears that you just have to make sure that both sides, and they're agreeing to this, would understand what they're agreeing to. I'm concerned about, a little cabin owner who gets caught doing something that, are they going to know what they're agreeing to or not in terms of a mediation? But the fact that they're going to be asked to sign a legal document, you would hope they'd seek counsel if they needed it.
Mr. Lockes?
Madam Chair, Representative, and in any orders that we issue, we outline what the individual's rights are and that they can demand a hearing, they can go through this process, and our role is to see that the issue is resolved. If it's placed bill, maybe the bill needs to come out and to deal with the resource protection aspects. But we do provide the individuals their rights, and so they are, and if they need counsel, that's up to them. But you can go through the administrative hearing process without counsel.
Okay. Any further questions from members? Anybody in the audience that would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Cox would like to make the final comment before we vote on your bill.
I appreciate the comments that you made, and I'm also supportive of the amendment that you put on with the expedited rulemaking. I think that'll assure everyone that the rules will be understood and clear for people as they're put into place, and I look forward to bringing this to the civil law.
Thank you. We're ready to vote. Okay, the motion is renewed through Representative McNamara that House File 789, as amended, be recommended pass and be re-referred to civil law. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and bill is passed to civil law. Thank you, Representative Cox.
Thank you.
Members, the next bill up is Representative Hoppe's House File 847. And we have kind of a different situation with this bill today in that we had it scheduled on the agenda, but unfortunately it didn't move through the revisor's office fast enough from the Environment Committee to have the bill officially before us today. So I believe you will see this today in the floor session on our blue sheet that it's moving to our committee. So we want to keep the bills moving, so what we can officially do today is talk about the bill. We can't take any action as far as amendments or moving it to the next committee, but my intention is that this would be on the agenda tomorrow because it will be moving to us officially today. And at that point tomorrow, we're hoping that there can be, very little discussion since we're doing that today. And we'll take the official action on it tomorrow in committee. So with that, Representative Hoppe. Okay. Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would normally say I'd like to move this bill, but I guess we'll just chat. This is the game and fish bill. It's got a bunch of things in it we probably all like to talk about. It's my understanding that today we have four rule provisions that we're changing, and we do not have the latest engrossment, as the chair stated, from the Game and Fish Committee. It's still in limbo, so there might be another rule change, but I don't think so. I think this is it. Real quickly, I'll go over them, then we can ask questions. I also have Mr. Bogus here from the DNR, who knows what he's talking about, unlike me. The four things are special management tags for fish, primarily sturgeon, replacement gear licenses, wetlands or lakes being closed to motorized decoys, and the measurement of fish length in the game and fish regulations. Very brief description with that, members. I would be open to questions, however, no amendments.
Thank you. First up, Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, I noticed in the repealer section on page 1R at the end that current law allows a person to have a raccoon, one raccoon to train dogs for raccoon hunting, and you're repealing that. Is that reinstated somewhere, or are we just saying you can have multiple raccoons? What do we do if you have if you want to do this?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Seifert. I will give you a brief explanation and turn it over to Mr. Bogus from the DNR. I think they're changing that to make it so that people can still train their coon dogs. I just don't think they can any longer have a raccoon in possession. They can go out and use the publicly owned raccoons like everyone else.
Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Seifert. That's pretty close.
Good.
Mr. Bogus, would you identify yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I'm Ed Bogus with the Division of Fish and Wildlife from the Minnesota DNR. We have not issued these types of permits for many years. It allows a person to take a raccoon basically from the wild to use for training purposes. We've not been issuing these types of permits. They are available for people to purchase through game breeders and things like that, but it's just not something that we've been doing. We think it's just some obsolete language, so it's not reinstated anywhere else. It just basically eliminates taking a raccoon from the wild to use for dog training purposes.
So, Madam Chair, a hunter could, if this bill goes through and so forth, take a raccoon from the wild and use it. It's just you don't need to get a permit now?
Mr. Bogus?
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, no, they would not be able to take a raccoon from the wild to use for this purpose. If they wanted a raccoon to use for this purpose, they'd have to purchase one from a game breeder. However, the law does allow running of raccoons year-round, and so there is already a lot of opportunity with wild raccoons to do the training.
Representative Seifert, I'm not aware of anyone that does this anymore. I think it's outdated, and most people that have coon dogs, there are so many raccoons around, it's relatively easy to go out and run your dogs and find some for training.
You can chase the raccoon, you just can't keep it in a cage or something.
Madam Chair and Representative Seifert, that's correct. Also in the bill, there are provisions in there as far as coon hunting goes where you can chase the coons during the bird nesting season. You just can't hunt them. I think it's a 2-month closed period. The rest of the year it's legal in the state to hunt raccoons all you want.
Okay, next up is Representative Kahn.
Where does this bill go next?
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, I believe it goes to Environment Finance.
But I did notice something which tried to get rid of. The fees are annually appropriated instead of appropriated by the legislature, and I hope Environment Finance will look at that.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. I don't remember who, but I did talk to one representative that wanted to address that when it came to finance.
Okay. And then the
Representative
Kahn. Just something that looked kind of interesting. There's something about predatory wild animals and also destroying their dams, dens, and wherever that is.
Okay.
What is there a definition of predatory wild animals, or is it just a wild animal not behaving well?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Kahn, that gives me great latitude as far as my answer. I think I'll turn that one over to Mr. Bogus. I'm not sure if there's a direct answer in the bill or if it's something currently in statute. The reason that provision is in there, it's I think primarily for beavers, to give people the opportunity to not just get rid of animals that are a nuisance on the farm or their property, but to make it so the beavers feel very unwelcome and don't wish to come back.
Well,
Representative
Kahn. Chairman, I remembered one year, and I can't, it's like my ability to remember the fights more than anything else, but that was a big issue about destroying beaver dams, and it's the question of who I'm actually remembering back. And I know that there was a big the question at the time was there was a beaver dam on somebody's property, and they liked it because they liked having the beaver around. Mm-hmm. But the people either upstream or downstream didn't like it. And the question was, who had the right to destroy that dam? And is this the is it all under the order of the commissioner, or does the person who's who has the right to, in that, going back to that case, who has the right to destroy a beaver dam?
Representative Hoppe.
I'll turn that over to Mr. Boggs.
Mr. Boggs.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, there are some, this provision in this bill does not address the situation you're talking about. There are some provisions in existing statutes that address the situation where you've got one landowner who has a beaver dam, and it's impacting an adjacent landowner. And maybe the one who has the beaver dam wants to keep it and the adjacent landowner doesn't. And there are some provisions in existing statute that refer those types of situations to a district court, and then the commissioner can either take or order action to be taken. What this provision does in this bill is it's really a clarification of some past practice. Our commissioner's looking at our authorities pretty closely, and we have all these authorities to remove the predatory animals and so forth, but it's not clear the structures. And we've always interpreted in the department that if we can issue a permit to remove beaver, we can also issue a permit to remove a dam or a house that's in a boat lift or something like that. But it's not clearly spelled out in statute. So this would just clearly spell that out in statute, that if we can issue a permit for someone to remove an animal that's causing damage, we can also issue a permit for them to remove the structure.
And that could be any animal. There's no definition of predatory wild animal.
Madam Chair and Representative Kahn, that is not a defined term. It would be any wild animal that's causing damage. Could be.
Does it include people?
Is that a suggestion for an amendment, Representative Kahn?
No, just curious.
Okay, next up on the list, Representative McNamara. Sorry. Keep catching you out of your chair today. Representative McNamara.
My question, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Boggs, under current rulemaking, do you have the authority in Camp Ripley to allow bow hunting for turkeys? Would you have the ability under rulemaking to do that?
Mr. Boggs.
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, yes, we would have that authority right now. Camp Ripley is a statutory game refuge, which means it's closed to hunting unless opened by a rule of the commissioner. But we have broad authority to open refuges to hunting. In that particular case, the Department of Military Affairs pretty much has the say. We defer to what they want to allow in that particular refuge, but we do have the authority.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, I have two members on the list. First up, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On page 8, subdivision 5, I know there's already a good bit of regulation with regard to taking game like deer when they're damaging cropland. And I'm wondering if this would expand that at all, actually making it easier to issue permits for that purpose. If either one of you, Representative Hoppe or...
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Olson. No, this wouldn't change it. It just clarifies the law, and will destroy any deer lodges or nests or dams that we have to.
Madam
Representative Olson
and Representative Hoppe. So this is really not so much for this. This is really more for the department to have more authority to be able to do that.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Olson. I don't think it gives any more authority. I don't think you're going to see an increase in the number of permits. It just clarifies the law, and it's primarily dealing with beavers, so that gives people a little bit more latitude in taking care of a problem where beavers are damaging property.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hoppe, we should have passed this law when I was a kid. We had a lot of problems. I'm glad we're dealing with that finally, but the way it reads, I don't know why it couldn't also apply to deer, and I actually wish it did, because we had some huge, enormous problems out our way, these fast-growing areas, and I'll just leave that for comment. You don't need to respond, but I would hope that there's some way we could improve that process, because problems had to get really out of hand, and there was a lot of car accidents or cars hitting deer before we ever really got the problem solved. And I don't know if it's fully solved yet.
Okay, three members on the list now. First up, Representative Seifert.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, is just looking at page 14 of the bill on, I know we're getting into DNR and environment issues, but I don't sit on that committee and just thought it'd be good to ask these so I don't have to ask you later. On leaving decoys, right now it's kind of, I know what, basically sunset when you're ready to start in the morning, I guess, is when you're not supposed to leave decoys out. And we're going to say now that during any part of the day you can't leave them out more than 2 hours. Are all the groups, Ducks Unlimited, etc., good with that? We had kind of a big discussion on this in Ways and Means last year. I don't know why, but...
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Seifert. It is a... anytime you talk about issues involving ducks, it's controversial with the large segment of our population that likes and supports duck hunting. As far as where the groups are, I'll turn that over to Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Feigen.
Madam Chair, Representative Seifert, this is an issue that we took out to our public meetings last spring. It did come up in the legislature last year. Didn't get attached to any bill, but it was debated, as you mentioned. And so we took some public comment on it last spring. And of the people that came to the meetings or emailed us their comments, about 70% were supportive of this type of a restriction. Certainly not everybody is, but the organized groups have not indicated any opposition to this.
Okay, thank you.
Next up is Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hoppe. I just kind of going over on this bill. I don't claim to be an expert on all of this. It's looked real good and a lot of things. I was going through, though, on page 10, line 26, and it's related to small game. And I just had a question, or maybe you can clarify, on the age 12 and under to be accompanied by a parent, and that's with a firearm and those sort of things. So it just kind of makes me a little nervous. Not that I don't trust all parents, but just to have kind of a wide open, you know, I mean, conceivably you could have a 3-year-old maybe with a parent. It just seems like there might need to be like a limit to that, and sometimes not all parents show good judgment, so that would be a little bit of a concern for me. And maybe it's addressed in here, and it was just my lack of understanding, but it's just the way I read it, maybe I read it wrong, but it's age 12 and under, and then if they were with a parent, they're fine to shoot away. So that just makes me a little uncomfortable, and maybe I just misunderstood it.
Representative Hoppe, I know we discussed this in Environment Committee too, but Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lilly. I don't think it's a bad question. And are you talking about the trapping provision or the turkey hunting provision or the youth hunting under the age of 12 in general?
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Kind of what I'm referring to is the small game portion with firearms is probably where I'm a little, you know.
Sure.
Just a little concerned.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Lilly. This is in current statute. Currently, there is no minimum age requirement or limit on how young somebody has to be to go hunting. It's perfectly legal to take a 3-year-old hunting. You can't hunt and tag or take a deer legally in Minnesota, for example, unless you pass the firearm safety course, but the theory is that, you know, if you bring a 3 or 4 year old, and again, all of this is up to parental, you know, what the individual parents think of their child is able to handle. You know, obviously, a 3 or 4 year old can't hunt. I mean, they can go along, they can walk along, pheasant hunting or squirrel hunting or whatever it would be, and you have to take care. You know, there are attendant safety issues and endurance issues for a child, and you know, frankly, if you're going to shoot around a kid that's that young, you better make sure their ears are well covered up. But that's the way it is in current statute. There's no minimum age. It just states that once you get to the age of 12, you have to take firearm safety. And there is a provision in this bill for turkey hunting where kids under the age of 12 would be able to legally take a turkey if they have a parent within arm's reach or a guardian. And the reason that's in there is because with turkey hunting, you would have to be, I mean, you'd probably literally be touching, your bodies would be that close And you have to have a parent with you and that close. So, good question.
Okay, next up is Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative...
Representative Dempsey, can you pull your mic down, please?
Representative Hoppe, on page 9, what is the reason for lines 19 through 26?
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey. I'll let Mr. Vargas respond to that.
Mr. Vargas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Dempsey. This is to establish a uniform standard for what constitutes proof of residency. We have a definition of residency. They have to reside permanently in the state for at least 60 days prior to purchasing the game and fish license. But we have we have close to 1,800 license vendors across the state, and they've used a variety of things to verify proof of residency. And this would just clarify that for residents of the state to verify residency once they reach the age of 21 years, that they would need to have either a Minnesota driver's license or a state of Minnesota identification card, not a utility bill receipt for the last 2 months or something like that, which has been used in the past.
And Madam Chair, to add to that, I think one of the things we have in Minnesota, we have a huge white-tailed deer herd. We have very good hunting opportunities, the best in the nation for rough grouse. We have, depending on where you go and who you know, pretty good pheasant hunting and fishing. We have some of the best fishing in the country. And I think what we're trying to do is not only have conformity, but make sure that somebody from, not picking on any states, but Wisconsin or Illinois or wherever it would be, can't come here and claim to be a resident in terms of picking up a deer license or being able to take more walleyes or something like that.
And Madam Chair, a follow-up.
Representative Dempsey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And was Representative, was this information that came from the DNR?
Representative Hoppe.
Madam Chair, to the best of my knowledge, it was. It was in the bill as it presented to me.
Good. Thank
you. To this point, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Hoppe or Mr. Vargas, what's the DNR's position on students over the age of 21 that are attending college in regards to residency license?
Mr. Vargas.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, current law, and I can't recall it exactly, but current law allows students who are attending, full-time students who are attending school in Minnesota, to obtain a license at a resident fee, I believe, and I don't recall that there's an age. I'd have to check on that.
Representative McNamara.
Does this legislation affect them if they're a 22-year-old student?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara, that's a good question. We'll double check that. I can't answer it right now.
This is going to be back here tomorrow.
Right, yeah, we'll take official action on it tomorrow. So if there's a way to get that answer overnight, that'd be great. Next up is Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question is actually going back to some government ops responsibilities. And,
thank you.
I don't think we even have the bill here in the format. We'll see it tomorrow. But I'm not familiar with, on page 18, section 29, we have the good cause exemption to amend rules, and I'm not familiar with what that is or how that works. I don't think I've seen that in any of the bills coming before us. If someone, perhaps Mr. Shepherd, could explain what that is.
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, under current law, there is something called a good cause exemption, and the specific clause referenced there is when an agency is amending one of its rules to incorporate specific changes set forth in statute when no interpretation of law is required. So if you look on page 18, line 5, it refers back to section 26, which is the statute dealing with measurement of fish length, and it's changing the statute to change how you measure fish length. to refer to the jaw instead of just the nose and the farthest tip of the tail. I assume the DNR has a rule that also does that. And this good cause exemption would allow them to amend the rule exactly to reflect the change in the law without having to hold a public hearing and go through a lot of process if all they're doing is just incorporating the change in the applicable law.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Shepherd and Madam Chair. Is it typical? I mean, I understand with the DNR issues its rules to with the license, and so this is sort of a unique situation in terms of trying to keep the public informed. But I would assume we don't typically do dual provisions of the same material in rules and statutes. Is that correct?
Mr. Shepherd.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, it is unusual that a statute and a rule would contain entirely duplicative material, but sometimes a rule does need to be changed to reflect a change in statute. For example, if there used to be a 30-day notice requirement and the legislature bumps it up to 60, the agency may need to change its rule. And so it, under the existing law, they can use this good cause exemption. Some agencies, like the DNR is doing here, specifically bring it to the attention of the legislature just so everybody knows that it's okay to use this good cause exemption. So it's not uncommon, but it's also not something that occurs a great deal.
Representative Loeffler.
That's all. Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions from members? Is there anybody from the audience that would like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Kahn.
Another question. On page 11 of the bill, I noticed the word family is changed to married couple, and I also noticed that that's only for non-resident fishing. Is that treated a resident treated differently than non-resident, and what's the reason for changing family to married?
And I think that came up in environment as well.
Okay.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Kahn. That did come up in environment as well, and I think it's just standardization. And to make sure that, and Mr. Bogus would dispute this, but I think it's to make sure my interpretation is that when you use the word family, if you've got a whole bunch of kids that should be purchasing fishing licenses, I think we want to make sure that they're purchasing fishing licenses and they're not as part of the family.
Okay. But and the question is, I noticed this is only under non-resident fishing. Is it the same language then used in resident fishing?
Mr. Vargas.
Madam Chair, Representative Kahn, there is no resident family license, and this does make it the same as the 14-day license that you see on line 22, which is for a married couple.
Oh. Okay. Any other further questions or anybody from the audience? You know, members, I think just to see the variety of things that we do here in government op, you know, we've been talking about firefighter training today, administrative penalties, and now the game and fish. So I just have to ask you the question, Representative Hoppe. Page 3, lines 20 and 21, please tell me what a tadpole, mad tom, and stone cat is. Representative Hoppe, it's in your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There will be a quiz later. And I'll let Mr. Bogus give you the explanation, but these are a popular type, or at least with some people, a popular type of bait fish. And they are primarily found, or used to be primarily found, in the Mississippi River. And because of the spread of zebra mussels, thank you, mental block. Because of the spread of zebra mussels, we can no longer go to the Mississippi River. Bait dealers can't go and net any of these bait fish or bait minnows used for bait fish. So that's the rough explanation. I'll let Mr. Bogus give you the real explanation. I'm done rambling.
Mr. Bogus.
Madam Chair, just to expand a little bit further, they're a small species of fish. They're actually in the catfish and bullhead family, but they don't get very large, and they're found in a variety of waters in Minnesota. They're more of a small, they would look like a small catfish or a small bullhead, and they are capable of stinging like those fish are, but they are a popular bait, at least on the Mississippi River.
Thank you. Representative McMurray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this actually is to this point, and I guess it would also exemplify the wide range. I have an uncle that fishes quite a bit, and I know that these willow cats are extremely effective and they like to fish with them. What actually is the implication of this law? I happen to live in a community on the Mississippi River. I don't know where he gets his willow cats from. Are they legal to fish with if under any circumstance?
Madam Chair and Representative McNamara, this was something that we had to cut off the supply of these, basically, or the sale of them by Minnesota minnow dealers last year because of the infested water provision that they couldn't take them from the Mississippi, and they were classified as a minnow only on border waters with Wisconsin, and Wisconsin continues to allow them. So this really created a hardship for some of our minnow dealers on the Minnesota side who had sources from inland waters that weren't infested waters where they could have taken them. And so we committed to trying to fix this as quickly as we could so they could go back into the business. But since last May or so, they've been unable to sell this bait, and it is a popular bait, as you say, in the southeastern part of the state.
Representative Hoppe.
I had one thing I forgot to add. This when Representative Leffler, I think, had the question about good cause. There's one other thing in this bill where that will be used. One of the things we're going to do is change the dates of the fishing season. This year, for example, the fishing season ended on a Sunday in February, and President's Day was a holiday for most of the state's workers because most state workers work for the government these days. And what the DNR would like to do is just extend that, instead of saying the third Sunday in February, just extend it to the last Sunday in February. So on every, how many every year, 6 or 7 years, that we'd be able to capture or let people fish on President's Day.
Thank you. Members, as we mentioned, we're not going to move on this bill today, but Representative Hoppe, if you can be prepared tomorrow to point out the engrossments in the version that we'll see tomorrow, any of the amendments that got put in.
Just like the Boy Scouts, we'll be prepared.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Members, before we adjourn, I'd like to just go over a few announcements here. Tomorrow, the bills up are listed on the bottom of your agenda there. We'll officially move on Representative Hoppe's bill, and hopefully there shouldn't need to be a lot of discussion on that. Representative Earhart has a bill about highway signs. Representative Beard has the design build legislation. That may be a little bit lengthier discussion tomorrow. And then Representative Wilkins' bill on persons with disabilities. And then next Tuesday and Wednesday, we're going to be taking up Representative Powell's bill on the Emergency Powers Act, which should be kind of a lengthy discussion, and Representative Earhart's bill on the salary cap for communities. And also in your packet, there's a handout that is a typed-up version of the dates that I mentioned yesterday for potential additional meetings that we'll be having. And so, you know, if you've got other plans in your community, if you could make arrangements to be here for those meetings. We're hoping to maybe not meet during all of those times, but I want to make sure that people have those dates available. As you know, when we get closer to first and second deadline now, the bills will start coming a lot faster. And so those will be our additional times, and I'm hoping to avoid Saturdays and Sundays. So if you can please be dedicated to get to those meetings so we have quorums and can vote on bills, that would be greatly appreciated.
Madam Chair, on the evening hearings, yeah. What time are you thinking, 6:30? And I'll have my L.A. put a question mark and put him on the schedule now.
Good point.
But what time should I kind of have him block off? Which is the six, no, what Rhodes did, is it 6 to 9?
Yeah, typically... you know, on days that we have session or there's other committee hearings, we'll wait till those finish up and maybe give a short break for dinner. And then so we'd come back for dinner planning on being out of here by, a decent hour.
Okay.
So 6 to 9 is fairly close. We'll adjust that accordingly. And we don't have any rooms reserved at this point. They have kind of a different process this year. So we may end up being in a couple different rooms, but just watch the schedule. Then I just have another quick announcement. In my district today, there's 20 soldiers returning from Operation Iraqi Freedom. And, in fact, in Anoka, while I'm on the House floor tonight, today there'll be a police-escorted parade welcoming back those soldiers. So it's nice to have some good news about our soldiers from time to time. So with that, members, meeting is adjourned.